Skeptia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
Good afternoon. This is a podcast done from the Southbank Centre here in the central London, and we are with the managing director of Pushkin Press, a very reputable editorial house in the UK that specializes in translation. And with my partner in crime for this podcast, Jorge Ramirez. And with us is the managing director and owner of Pushkin Press, Adam Tottenham. Adam, thank you for agreeing to this interview.
Thank you for having me.
First question, how big is your gamble with Pushkin Press?
What do you mean by that?
I mean,
think it's very risky to publish books in translation?
No. I mean, in this time and age, and in the English-speaking world, which is dominated by certain writers, and the production and dissemination of material, particularly literature, is so powerful in English language that when you bring writers from another world, and particularly writers which are not very well known, you don't expect to have a bigger impact. You seem to be very concentrated on a very specific group of people. Educated, well-read English readers with a taste for foreign fiction. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure I accept all of what you've said, because I think that ideally, of course, we're trying to reach the widest possible readership with the books that we do. So, some of the books are perhaps more sophisticated than others, and it is true that we have literary tastes and we're not publishing the most popular fiction. On the other hand, we also have a crime list, we have a children's list that's been very successful, so we're trying to reach lots of different kinds of readers, but it is true that we're not publishing commercial fiction per se. But it is a niche, of course, the fact that we're working on translated books, but I think that the potential market is huge, put it that way, and that's kind of, for me, even though it is a gamble, it feels like a gamble that so far is paying off.
And is Pushkin Press a national home for you? I was reading about your career, your background. Is Pushkin Press home at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a few events led me to where I am now, and in terms of my career. And I guess the one I would really highlight is publishing Alone in Berlin by Hans Fallada when I was at Penguin. And that was the first ever English publication of this book from 1947. And we published it in 2009 in hardback and in 2010 in paperback. And it was a bit of a phenomenon. And I think it sold close to 500,000 copies now for Penguin.
Yeah.
And that experience made me think a bit differently about what I was doing. So I had been working on translations a lot till then, but as a result of it, I got in touch with a lot of foreign publishers who were sort of saying, well, there aren't just classics that are undiscovered, there's lots of contemporary works that are overlooked. And that's what led me to where I am now, because there wasn't really the context to do that at Penguin in the way that it was structured at that time. So I decided to go out on my own.
So that German book with Penguin was your epiphany moment, so to speak.
In a sense. I mean, I do. What I also like about Pushkin is that, when you're in a big company, obviously, you're naturally it's only right that it is so, but you are restricted in a way. You know, you have a certain area that you're expected to publish in, and it's difficult to do things that are outside of that area. I mean, that's not always true, but it's often true, particularly in bigger companies. And so one of the things I really like about Pushkin is that I was able to, I set up the children's list at the beginning.
Yes, you did. Which has been very successful.
And then that's been terrific. And then I set up this crime imprint, and then the English language imprint won. We're kind of doing everything.
And increase the
nonfiction. And I really like that. And we have, an editor at large who works on our children's list. And it's really nice to be able to do all these different sorts of things. Whereas I could kind of dip my toe into some of these things, but not all of them with Penguins.
But
for me at this point in time, to answer your question, yes, it very much feels like a spiritual home.
So it started as a founding translation, so to speak, and now has been diversified to other things.
Yeah.
The kind of writers that you could, contemporary writers.
Yes.
But unknown and almost not very well known in English. In fact, I remember my first Pushkin experience, so to speak, as a reader, was reading Journey by Moonlight.
Yes.
Journey
by Moonlight was Pushkin's, prior to my taking it over, was Pushkin's biggest book. And it was the first ever English translation of that.
And it's
a classic. In 2000, yeah. And it did strike a chord, and it did extremely well. And the other thing they were known for was reviving Stefan Zweig.
Yeah, indeed.
Bringing back mostly old translations, in fact, and then only laterally new translations. Ironically, it was in response to my wanting to commission more Zweig when I was at Penguin,
really?
That prompted the then owner of Pushkin to try and do some new translations themselves. And we now have over 30 translations of Zweig in print.
Really? Wow. But and biographies too, because he was a biographer
too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Mary Stuart.
He was a bestseller in the world.
That's right, absolutely. In the 20s and 30s, internationally, he was a bestseller. I wouldn't call him a bestseller now, but he does pretty well. I mean, the books are all in print and selling and reprinting regularly. And
he's been known in Latin America, as you can imagine, because of his Argentinian and Brazilian connections
in Persepolis, exactly. Yeah.
Well, he did commit suicide the day after he finished his last book.
With The World of Yesterday, exactly. Indeed. Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about the children's section, because it's been very successful. It has been your invention.
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking on the way here, I was thinking about this, Adam. I was thinking about, okay, look at the big, best-selling books of the moment. They tend to be children's literature. Mm-hmm. What does he say about the publishing world right now?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of successful children's books, but...
But the really global ones,
books.
You know.
Oh, the global... You mean a la Harry Potter?
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Things like that. I don't know whether they're only children's books. I think what's really happened is there is this globalization, of course, of literature that's happened in a way that is not all positive. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of the way that the bestseller charts are often boringly uniform between countries now in a way that they wouldn't have been, you know, 30 years ago. And it's very striking how across Europe how many, not all, but how many of the top titles will be
the same ones.
And I don't think that's just limited to children's books. Yeah. But with the children's list, I mean, I think the initial impetus for me was quite simple. It was basically applying the same logic of the Pushkin list, which was a mix of modern classics from abroad and contemporary successes that hadn't yet been published in English. And I just wanted to apply that to the children's market. And that was because at the time that I sort of started thinking about children's books, my kids were quite young and they became big readers. And I hadn't been, I wasn't a children's publisher by training or background, but of course as a publisher you end up
thinking about it
and looking at it, and I was really struck by how few books were in translation, particularly contemporary books. There were a few obvious classics, and that was it. So initially it started with classics, and then we moved into more contemporary books, and we still do a mix of both. I mean, this autumn is a very good example, because we've got, in fact, this week we published a Dutch classic from the early 1970s called Winter in Wartime, and it's a new translation of that book. And at the same time, we published a new English language children's book called Katwinkel by an Australian writer, Elliot Perlman. They're both out this week. And then we have the German writer, children's writer Cornelia Funke. We've got a new collection of fairy tales that she's put together that's out next week. So it's a range of things.
And recently you sold the rights of the Beats player in the United States.
Yes, we did. Yeah, as a Japanese sort of teen, upper middle grade teen book. Yeah, it's a terrific book which you published.
There's a strong emphasis about Japan or Japanese literature.
Tell us about that
because for me I'm very foreign. I mean, I know three or four Japanese writers and that's it. But tell us about that experience. I mean, the Japanese market, as you know it, and how does it compare in terms of books and the dissemination of literature there?
Yeah. I have been to Japan once, but I'm no expert on the Japanese market. But I've always, for quite a long time, liked Japanese literature and found it really interesting. And that was true when I was at Penguin as well. And I put Kobo Abe into The Woman in the Dunes into Penguin Modern Classics, and David Mitchell did a new introduction of that for us at the time. So I had an interest in Japanese literature already. Then when I came to Pushkin, my co-founding partner, who's since left the company, Stephanie Sigmiller, she also was very interested in Japan. So it really, it just meant that early on, one of the things we were looking at was Japanese stuff. And we acquired several books by Ru Murakami some of them were republications, some were new, and we started looking at the children's list.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we've continued to do Japanese books is that they work, you know. It's really interesting. There is a real. There are certain things that are, we have found to be true about the way that we publish, and that is, Japanese things all seem to work, children's and adult, and Russian classics, Russian modern classics.
What do you think that is, Adam? Do you think it's the aesthetic? Do you think it's the sensuality of the writing, the ideas? What do you think?
I mean, with Japanese things, I mean, it is there's an attractive foreignness about it. It's a very different place. And even in my 1 week there, I think there's something really fascinating about it. And it felt much more, I've been in China and Korea as well, and it felt much more foreign to me than either of those places. Okay. It felt, you know, very distinct. And that, I think, has made the literature very interesting. Ironically, it is perhaps also the fact that Harumi Murakami's huge success has probably had a kind of halo effect. Although it's ironic that he's not a particular fan of Japanese literature and calls himself on American writers, that's what he really likes. But I still think that oversized success
has opened up.
I mean, I know, for example, I was talking to someone the other day about this. When I was at Penguin, we published a new translation of Akutagawa stories of Rashomon and some other things, and the translator was Murakami's translator, and he did an introduction, and so it did rather well. Okay. This book, I mean, much better than kind of comparable books on the list. And Soseki, Natsume Soseki, who's another Japanese writer, we also published some books of. And it was really interesting because we did a couple of them and they did fine, but nothing to write home about. And then we did one that was a republication by the same translator, Murakami, and Murakami did an introduction and it flew. Sometimes it is this kind of celebrity. I don't think that's everything about it. Yeah. I think there is also the, you know, because as I say, I don't think most of these writers have nothing in common with Murakami's writing, and yet, you know, they do well.
It's by association somehow.
Yeah, perhaps.
The same applies to the Nordic noir. You got a lot of writers from there.
We have a lot of Scandinavian writers, though not so much Nordic noir in particular.
No.
But you mean the same halo effect?
The effect that it got in the, at least in the Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, with Stieg
Larsson.
I don't
think it's only there. I think it impacts
everywhere. Yeah,
it's global.
Yeah, I think it definitely is.
But you got a lot of authors from the Scandinavian area.
Yes, we do. Yeah,
I mean, people. Yeah,
yes, we do. I think there's an interest in that literature, and in a sense, I think that's slightly different with Japan. I do think some of it is this curiosity about a very different kind of aesthetic and cultural sensibility that's so foreign and therefore so interesting. I think Scandinavia feels more familiar to people. And it's familiar and yet not at the same time.
It has a different sensibility.
There's a darkness something. But it's also done, to be honest, the thing we've done most of has been Dutch literature. We've done a lot of Dutch literature.
Yeah.
And I can't put my finger on something particularly Dutch about the books that we've done or their success.
Well, the Letter for the King has been particularly good for you, hasn't it? And it's quite interesting that Dutch writers are not very well known. The only one I can think of is Sis Nuttebom, who is used to be an Ispalist.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of relationship with Dutch literature. It remains very unknown. I mean, that was one of my questions. Before I jump the gun, I'm going to go back to Japanese. I saw in your catalogue there are quite a few female Japanese writers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Any coincidence there?
It is coincidence.
It's coincidence.
I think, we publish the writers that we come across, and it's regardless of gender in a way. I mean, there is this one series which is we kind of call the Japanese novella series, which is, they're not all novellas. They're either novellas or they're little collections, a couple stories. And that is it's a series of six books that we published over the last couple of years. And the there are two editors, one who's American and one who's based in Japan, and they've selected these books. And their kind of premise was that a lot of the best Japanese writing from the last couple decades in kind of adult fiction was in this shorter form, and that's why it hadn't been translated. So that's why they decided to do this. And that series has done well, and I think every book in the series has reprinted already, and sometimes more than once. You know, it's been very interesting, and in America too they've been very well received because we've been publishing them there, and at least half of the series have been reviewed in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Jorge was talking about the Scandinavian writers. Mm-hmm. How much do you attribute things like, for example, success of TV series, Scandinavian TV series, to certain interest in literature? Do you think that the two are correlated?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, obviously the you know.
So as a publisher, your antennae has to be kind of quite on most of the time about
general,
what's going on.
It has to be. And particularly today, I think, where we all know that there's a really television has become much more sophisticated, varied, and
well written.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot happening in Spain too. And I know there's a particular interest in Spanish language, both from Spain and Latin America. You know, when I talk to film and TV producers in London, I've noticed there's a real sense of wanting to find things for in those Spanish and for those markets, etc. So I think on the Scandinavian front, there's obviously been the success of The Killing and Borgen and all these things, which interestingly, and The Bridge, and all of them though arguably came after the books, like the TV followed the books, but then I think it's sort of mutually reinforcing. It's sort of, you know, you have the success of the books, then you have TV adaptations that take off, and then you have more books, and you know, it's a kind of it's kind of
symbiotic, isn't it?
But it's interesting because I would say at the moment it's probably past its prime, certainly in terms of the market. It doesn't mean that it's not selling anymore, but it just means that it's not the, you know, it's not the thing that people are thinking about and talking about and looking for.
And continue with the geography and the translation, or the geography of translations. That's happened to you, at least in Pushkin. That's, I presume you will have people reading in all these different languages, but then in certain countries that nothing comes out of it, or nothing appears to come out of it. Iceland, for example.
We published quite a few. Okay. Yeah, so that's it's sort of quite interesting. So we published a successful Icelandic children's book, and we have, which is called The Story of the Blue Planet, and we also have published two novels by an Icelandic author called Aude Eva Olofsdottir. The second one came out this year, we've published books on the Pushkin list from 24 languages.
Absolutely.
So, but your question is still there. Obviously, it's true. We haven't published anything Chinese yet, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're, you know?
Yeah,
you're
referring to. Yeah, or even for example, Senegal. No, I noticed that you got a Nigerian also, but there's particularly African writers writing in Spanish. There are African writers in Spanish. There are African writers in French.
Yes, the Francophone. We recently acquired a French Senegalese writer called David Diop, and a book of his called Frère Dame, which is, I think, shortlisted for 12 prizes in France. Okay. So they will be publishing, end of next year, early 2020. So, we don't look to this point, even despite what we've said about Japan, we don't really look at our acquisitions geographically. And a lot of people say, I think we don't really look at it that way. I mean, having said that, it is, of course, naturally true that inevitably, as individuals, as editors, we're more interested in some countries and cultures than others. I won't deny that. I don't think we can all be equally interested in every part of the world, right?
Absolutely.
It would be, and so that's just a. But that's not to say that there aren't interesting coming out of all over the place. I mean, if you'd asked me, did I think I would publish an Indonesian writer a couple of years ago? I probably would have said, well, I don't know. And suddenly we published two books by Eka Kurniawan, and I hope to publish more by him. He's very interesting.
Yeah.
But that's a. That was unexpected. It suddenly came my way.
Well, the question goes in two parts. The first part, I don't know if you see yourself as an anthologist, as a person who actually looks, you and your team at Pushkin, as an anthologist, a person who looks for stories and gripping stories from around the world, wherever they come from.
Yes.
Point one. Point two, think about the future of languages. Mm-hmm. The future of languages will depend on the cultural products of those countries or in those languages. Is Finnish language going to survive? In order for Finnish language to survive, you have to produce literature and films and cultural products to survive. Otherwise, we'll be absorbed by the large languages of the world, like Spanish and Chinese and English. It will happen. I mean, we're talking about 200 years.
Yes.
So your job, in certain ways, is a sort of kind of philologist and anthologist.
I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, you mentioned Iceland, and Iceland is, I think, people often forget just how small it is. There are 300,000 people in the entire country. And yet it has an incredibly rich literary tradition and filmic tradition.
And musical, too.
And musical, exactly, and poetry, and it's really interesting. Yeah. I'm amazed at how many... It's amazing, in a sense, that we publish as many Icelandic books as we have when you think about how few people there are, right, and how few writers there are compared to some other countries. I don't kind of think that I do have a sort of missionary zeal about what I do, but that's because I do care deeply about literature from all over the world, and I like the fact that we're It's exciting to bring something into English for the first time, you know, and even though we continue to sometimes publish writers who have been in English before, it's sort of always the most exciting thing is when you're bringing them into English for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, or that I'd just be honest about it. There's a real frisson that I get, and I think my colleagues get when the writer has never appeared in English before, and it's such a nice thing to be able to do. And, you know, sometimes that can be, or when a major book of theirs, again, Dutch, one of our biggest successes was The Evenings, which 2 years ago we published. It's a 1940s Dutch novel, which is generally considered in the Netherlands the best Dutch novel ever, or of the 20th century at least, and it had never been in English before.
No way.
Not for lack of interest, but partly because the author was a bit difficult, and, you know, he had his own ideas about it, and it was only quite a while after his death, you know, 50 years after his death that it happened. So
you have to wait for him to die.
Yeah. So anyway, but the book got, this was front page news in the Netherlands, this publication, this book. I'm not kidding, there were single newspaper, it was covered on TV and radio.
They have to be aware of that. I mean, they have to be such a sophisticated country, but then you get a major book published in English.
But then what was gratifying for us was that, of course, it's nice to think that it's news in the Netherlands, but the gratifying thing was that actually the book ended up getting a great reception in English. Amazing reviews, it was called a masterpiece, and The Guardian, The New York Times covered it. You know, we ended up selling, I think, 35,000 copies of this book, which no one had heard of, or the author had heard, you know.
My last question about geography.
Yes.
You're an American, you were born in Baltimore. How does it compare over the translation market in the United States compared to the UK? And I tell you this is a specific question for us, a Latin American reader. Why? Because it seems to us, and we have discussed this in the past, that for a Latin American writer to make it big in Europe, it has to go through the American market first.
Oh, that's interesting.
Would you agree with that? I know you got Newman from Argentina. You got a few of his books, but anyway, that's another story. But
I'm not sure that has to be true, but there obviously are a lot of Latin American writers who ended up coming through that route.
Yeah.
And I do think that over the last 20 years, there are more and more publishers, obviously, in the U.S. who are actively looking at it. And as you know, even who've actively set up Spanish language imprints, and that sort of feeds into it as well. And, you know, we published the Bolivian writer Rodrigo Hasbro, but he's based in Texas. But that's an example. We actually acquired his book first and then sold it to the American based in Texas.
Yes.
So, you know.
He was in Grant as well, in the anthology in Grant.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting the way that you come to different writers. And I wish I knew Spanish, to say.
Yeah.
I was in Argentina for the first time this summer, briefly, and then in Brazil, but I don't know Spanish or Portuguese, and so I rely on readers and, you know, and translators, etc., for suggestions. But I have a good network of people, we're actually always acquiring things from Spanish.
Well, I read Tomás González, Colombian, in a translation done by Questkin by Frank Wynne. I mean, I read it in English then I read it in Spanish. I'm surprised that you are not translating more of his books, because he has another book called La Luz Difícil, The Difficult Light.
I've read that one.
Yeah.
We did think about it. I like Gonzalez a lot, and I like that book a lot, and it didn't resonate quite the way that I'd hoped it would. I'll be honest, and it's sort of, they're always difficult decisions as a publisher.
Yeah, absolutely. And coincidentally enough, one of our last programs was at the Instituto Cervantes, and we were talking about Andrés Caicedo, Que Viva la Música, Live Forever, translated by Frank Wynne,
which I commissioned.
Penguin Classic.
Yeah,
you commissioned it. There you are. So I was going to ask you that.
I commissioned that from Frank. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
How did you decide that this European classics from the interwars, I'm talking about George Simmel, Italo Svara, all these writers that nowadays people don't know about them. How do you decide it?
What to do?
Yes.
Well, look, I have I'm from a German Jewish background, and I guess and a lot of these writers often are Jewish. I'm also a Germanist by training. That's what I study German literature. So I'm particularly interested in Central European literature myself. And that was part of why I was attracted to it in the first place.
Indeed.
You know, that it felt I had an affinity with it. And I already liked Zweig and
right of Hofmannsthal.
Yeah.
Nobody in Spanish is few translations.
Yeah.
Yes. Few people know about it.
But so, you know, we, so as a result, I think I'm just naturally interested in this area. But I also think there is an interest in the English-speaking world in this period. So I don't think people, of course, some writers are better known than others, but there is an interest in the interwar period and in literature from that period. I mean, as I said earlier, Russian stuff is always particularly good. We've done very well with Teffy, who we helped rediscover. Babel, And Babel was interesting because it wasn't a rediscovery, but I loved Babel.
He was very well known before. Yes. I think during the 50s. Yeah. In Latin America, people knew about him.
Yes, you know, he's fairly well known, I would say, in the English-speaking world. But I always had a sense that the translations were not as good as they might be. Okay. And when I got to Pushkin, one of the first things I did was I asked Robert Chandler, who's a very well-regarded translator, but also mentor of translators, and I just said, Robert, you know, I really like Babel, and I'm just wondering, you know, do you think he's worth doing a new translation? And I'm not kidding, within 5 minutes I got back, not only a yes, but here's an essay I wrote criticizing all the translations and what their shortcomings are. And this is where he's such a generous, amazing person. He doesn't say, I'll do it. No, he says, the person who should do it, the best person is to do it, this person. And he points to Boris Draliuk, who has done now for us Red Cavalry and Odessa Stories. Yeah. We've had an amazing success with them. They've been really well regarded. Yeah. And Boris has gone on to do other things. So I think that, you know, translators are hugely important, and also the network that they have and the way that they encourage each other and mentor them.
But my initial question to you, if Pushkin felt like home, was precisely because of your background, the Jewish-German background. And I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, but I would imagine that Zweig, Svevo, Svert, all these writers from Eastern Europe were better known in the German-speaking world before the English-speaking world.
Yes, definitely,
will happen.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Zweig is quite interesting, of course, because these days he actually sells best in France.
Really?
Yes.
Incredible.
So the place that Zweig today sells best is France.
Really?
And there are editions of everything, letters, you know, anything you want of Zweig's in French you can get.
Really?
And German publishers have talked about this too. And I think, interestingly, you mentioned his popularity. And his popularity is the thing that has probably slightly doomed him in the German-speaking world, in that they've, you know, there's this sense of him not being a proper writer, you know, of being too popular.
Exactly.
The cosmopolitan.
But just being too commercially successful.
But he was prolific. He was very prolific.
Oh, yeah, and he wrote a lot. Exactly. He's like a lot of prolific writers. He's uneven.
Yeah.
But I think his best work is absolutely terrific first rate. But also, I think there's room for... you know, some people often talk about the difference between Stefan Zweig and Josef Roth.
Yeah.
And Roth and Zweig, who were friends and knew each other, and Zweig actually financially supported Roth a lot of his life. You know, he was hopeless with money, and he was an alcoholic, etc. They're very different writers, actually, and I think to sort of say, oh, Zweig isn't as good as Roth, I mean, they're doing different things.
Yeah.
I appreciate both of them. I think they're both absolutely terrific writers. You know, to my mind, Beware of Pity does stand up there by Zweig with Radetzky March by Roth.
But Zweig was at the time of the best period of Vienna, wasn't he?
Austrian,
that's right.
Brilliant period of Vienna.
Yeah, yeah, he was born in the 1880s in Vienna.
Well,
that's right.
He knew Hoffman, Stalador, these
all those people, that's right, Schnitzler, etc.
Well, Vienna at the turn of the century was more ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
Physics, science, technology,
psychoanalysis.
Everything.
Architecture.
Of Vienna.
Architecture.
Yeah.
Painting.
The famous School of Vienna.
Vienna, the turn of the century.
No, that's right. Wittgenstein and everything.
Yeah, Wittgenstein,
everybody. Exactly. Yeah.
But let's talk about formats.
Mm-hmm.
We Latin Americans, we consider, and I think we actually, without being too pretentious, we are the best short storytellers in the world, I think. Well, not we, but the Latin American writers in general.
There's
and I can give you an example.
The Old Testament.
No, it is the Old Testament. but the Talmud, if you will, Shadow. It's a taboo to publish short stories here. Tell me why. But in other words, the novel is supreme, king,
yes,
is king.
Right, yes.
Why?
Yeah. I don't have a simple answer for that.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there obviously are plenty of examples of short story writers who have been successful. But I think that, you know, that commercially it is true that on the whole, it's easier to sell a novel than to sell a collection of stories by an individual writer. Yeah. This is broadly true in the market. Having said that, you know, our first big success in fiction at Pushkin, since I took over, was Edith Perlman's Binocular Vision. She's an American short story writer. Yeah. It was the kind of collected works from 30 years. She'd never been published in the UK before. We had an incredible reception and probably sold 25,000 copies of this book. Okay. And it was Fiction Book of the Year in the Sunday Times. Yeah. So, you know, there are
exceptions.
There are plenty of exceptions to that. I think the other thing is that in America, there's a lot more. There are many more places for, you know, in the U.S. there are many more places for short stories to appear on a regular basis. The New Yorker, obviously,
the
Atlantic, you know,
Harper's, the magazine world,
and all of that is
much more
than in the U.K. Yeah. Exactly, and so I think that has fed into
that's
things.
True. Actually, the presence of, you know, literary magazines matters.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. Yeah. But I think that, and I still think that in general, I find this even as a bias among quite, I would say, intelligent, educated readers that I speak to outside of the publishing world, who often say to me, oh, I don't really like short stories. And I think that's such a, you know, it's just like with novels, there are great short stories and there are not so great short stories, there are great novels.
It's a very odd thing to say.
Yeah, but also, we were talking about this, and of course, classics are kind of the exception to this, because like Babel's, Check all these things. People are very happy to read classic short stories. I think that something about the idea of the short story doesn't attract people.
But see what is interesting, Adam? Here, you have to make it initially as a novelist in order to be considered okay for a short story. In Latin America, you don't need to be a novelist.
Yeah.
Look at
Borges.
Never wrote a novel.
It's Rulfo, Pedro Paramo, which is a different story.
So yes. We do accept the writer without the novel. We are writer by the short story.
No, you're right. Well, I mean, look, the only one I can point to in English is, of course, Alice Munro. But it is true. She was until quite late in her career, she was hampered by the fact that she wasn't a novelist.
That was my question to you, because you have mentioned these novella series with the Japanese writers.
Yes.
And that's the difference between the short story and the novella, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there is a difference there, because Munro is a novella. It's not a short story per se. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, the boundaries are quite... But it's like you know, Richard Ford did a collection, I don't know if you know, for granted, called The American Book of the Long Story, and you know, which is basically novellas, you know. But I think I don't know where the boundary is exactly.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I do also think that there has been more and more recently. There's much more interest in the English-speaking world in novellas. Basically, we don't want to call them that. They're short novels, for whatever reason, the publishing world. But definitely shorter works. Yeah. There are quite a few examples of shorter works that have been successful.
Munro was Nobel Prize 2 years ago. You know,
Alice Munro that we were just talking about.
Yes,
she
was Nobel Prize.
She was
a couple of years ago. I think she's superb. I think she's brilliant.
But I think she is a short story writer, and in a way, probably the proof is that all her stories were always published as collections of stories rather than saying, you know, you don't really find her one of them on its own, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
She tended to, even if you'd only had four or five in a book, there were still four or five.
Just almost to finish now, Adam, you got certain writers that are kind of, even for us, are kind of not well known, and you seem to have one or two of those books. Writers, you know, I didn't know, for example. I was looking at making a list,
Margaret
Millar, for example.
Villalobos.
Or Vasconcelos, which is a fascinating story.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by his story. He was a sparring boxing partner.
Yeah.
Then in a banana plantation.
Yes,
then what else he did? I don't know, whatever he was. And before becoming a writer.
Yeah.
Very interesting story. Fascinating.
Actually, that you're talking about My Sweet Orange Tree.
My Sweet Orange Tree.
That's a really interesting example of how things can feed into each other. So this is a Brazilian book. It was written in Portuguese in 1968. It was first published. And it's been very successful, not just in Brazil, but in lots of other countries, in Korea and in Russia, etc. And our one of our editors, Daniel Seaton, is married to a Turkish woman.
Okay.
And he moved to Turkey a couple years ago. And one of the books that she talked to him about, just in close, this one, assuming that he would know it, because it was a classic for her. And he'd never heard of it, of course, because it had been out of... It was actually published in English, but it was out of print for 40 years. And so he looked into it and he, you know, read it and thought it was fantastic. And so that's what led us to it. So, and it's a staple in on the curriculum in Turkey. And actually, it was recently republished in Spain. I know that by... I can't remember the publisher at the moment, but they've done quite well with it, and they've also found that they have a big schools market for it. We find our books in all different sorts of ways, through, you know, personal connections like that, through writers, through translators, through our own kind of research and just, you know, reading, lots of different ways.
And finally, how do you see the book market progressing now with the digital era, now with... I'm sure you have heard this so many times.
Yes.
The death of the novel.
Yeah.
I presume, I don't know how many
times.
In the last 20 years, you're not worried about it. How is the symbiosis between the digital and the printed world?
Symbiosis is a good word. I think there was this fear that's now long gone.
That the format will disappear.
Yeah, exactly. And somehow there was this sense briefly, not so much. To be honest, I think most publishers really didn't think that things were going to go the way of the music world. But still there was fear, and that has gone away, and I think it's gone away for, you know, the simple reason that the digital format seems to have plateaued very much. It is about 20% of the market, and it coexists quite happily, and there's a real sense that readers aren't choosing between, you know, ebooks and print books, but it's both.
Well, I presume you have your digital catalogue.
Of course, yeah. Almost,
how well is it doing, may I ask?
Yeah, sure. About 10% of
10%,
our sales
okay,
are digital.
Fine, okay.
And I think that is, you know, and it's higher on...
Even
that's
for the children's...
Everything. Children's books, interestingly, in the market generally, have not migrated to
digital.
E-book. And I think that's, I mean, look, based on my own three children, none of them are particularly interested in reading ebooks. They all prefer print. And I just, I think I think partly, interestingly, I think the other thing that might mean that the formats coexist is that part of the appeal that the book may have and continue to have versus the digital is precisely that you're spending your whole, so much of your life, often in school, in your homework, you know, in all these contexts, you're on a computer, on a screen. And so it's quite refreshing to then have a book and just be looking at it, you know. And I'm sure we all
and
might feel that.
Rather,
exactly.
The physicality,
we might all feel that.
Book, yes.
But I think that the younger generation, there's often a feeling, often sort of, you know, people our age and older often think, oh, it must be young people who are reading. And I don't think that's true. It's actually often older people who are reading ebooks because they can make the print bigger for their eyes, or because they're traveling so much and they, you know, and they're reading so much and they don't want to carry the books with them. I think the kind of 15 and under generation are largely reading print.
And the very, very last question from me. Adam, how big do you want to be with Pushkin Press? And the question is this. It must be like a family, because you have a small printing house.
Yes.
I don't know how many people, 16, 17.
No, smaller.
It must be like a family.
Yeah.
So, is it not the fear that if you become too successful, you become too big?
Yeah.
That sense of.
Yes, it would be a nice problem to have one. Nice problem to have.
Nuclear family.
Yes.
From
nuclear family
exactly.
To dysfunctional family.
I mean, exactly. I mean, I don't know if my. You know, we're a little bigger than a family, but it definitely everyone shares a sort of sense of the kind of passion and the mission that we have, I hope. I don't have. I want us to continue to grow, but in a kind of steady way rather than, you know, in a massive way. And I think personally I enjoy working where I know all the books and where I'm, you know, where I know everyone working for us and all of that. I like the size of the company, and so I think we'll grow, but I don't think we'll quadruple in size. You know, maybe we'll end up doubling in size in the coming years or something like that.
So this is an inversion from... nuclear family to extend the family.
Exactly.
The opposite is happening now.
Yeah.
Families, social life.
Adam Sondheim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Good.
Septia Radio. From London. A bilingual radio. To listen and think.